On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are so many American icons you won't find in the nation's rustic Amish schools. There are no sports, no bands, no sex ed, no guidance counselors, no college recruiters. But this week, two terrible American icons showed up with a sickening vengeance in Amish country, murder and the gun. And worse, murder and the gun in a schoolhouse. Five little girls are dead. The Amish are remarkably forgiving, but this is the third deadly school shooting in a week. Colorado, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. And violent crime is on the upturn nationally again. Why do we do this? Up next on Point, the Heart of Darkness. Why Americans, from schoolyard to highway, reach for the gun. We will hear in this hour from one of the nation's leading forensic psychologists, from Richard Slotkin, author of Gunfighter Nation, and more. But first, joining me from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is Scott Gilbert, who's covering the Amish school shooting for WITF, the National Public Radio member station in Harrisburg. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Where does the mourning stand there today?
Well, right now, the eye really in the area is as much on the condition of the five young Amish girls as anything else. As of yesterday, four were in critical condition, one was in serious condition. Now, as of this time, two are in serious condition, three are in critical. So one has been upgraded overnight.
So, but with a death toll of five already, there could, we pray not, but there could still be more deaths here.
There could be. Those three who are in critical condition, you know, critical is the worst condition. It's really pretty much means touch and go. And until they're upgraded, there is no indication as to whether or not they'll survive.
And the five who have died, how has their death been observed in Amish country there?
Well, it's just been a very serious blow because, as we've heard throughout many media reports, the Amish community is such a tight community. And even the non-Amish who live as neighbors to those in this part of what we call Bart Township or in the village of Nickel Mines here in Lancaster County, it's just everyone is just so close and as a result so devastated because it seemed when I was on the scene on Monday, it seemed that you really, everyone who you talk with just on the street has some sort of connection. Indirect, if not direct, to the families who are involved.
How has the understanding of the killer, Charles Carl Roberts IV, how has it deepened in the days since the shooting, Scott?
Well, that was a humongous question mark on Monday, especially because police were talking in some cryptic terms about something that was on his mind that happened 20 years ago for which he was seeking revenge. Well, now we have since learned that in a note he left for his wife, he reflected on good times they had together and his love for her, but also two major things that have been weighing heavily on his mind lately. One of them is the death of their daughter, Elise. It was a daughter that he and his wife had just 9 years ago, and she lived for just 20 minutes. She was born prematurely. And he explained in the note to his wife that he never really got over this. And every time he and his wife and their other three children went to an event or went out and tried to do something fun over the past 9 years, all he could think about was the fact that Elise wasn't there. So he says her death fueled a hatred for himself, for life, and even a hatred for God.
He wrote, "I am filled with so much hate toward myself, hate toward God, and an unimaginable emptiness. It seems like every time we do something fun, I think about how Elise wasn't there, and I go right back to anger." But that wasn't the only thing. There's also the 20-year-ago incident. What have we learned about that?
It was, and that was something he only alluded to in the note. He said there's something he said to his wife in the note that I can't tell you about that happened 20 years ago, but it's been weighing very heavily on my mind. It wasn't until a cell phone conversation on Monday morning, minutes before the shootings happened, when he was talking to his wife and he disclosed to her what that was. And he told her that 20 years ago, and he was just about 12 years of age, he molested two female family members between the ages of 3 and 5, and that recently, he had been having dreams of committing that again. Over the last couple of weeks, he had been having very intense dreams of committing acts of molestation again, and he had been unable to control the impulse to act upon those dreams, and that's what he disclosed to her shortly before he hung up with her, and she never heard from him again.
He came to the one-room schoolhouse with a pickup truck full of supplies, indicating he may have had just that plan, just that kind of molestation in mind.
Absolutely. The police have said that there are several intentions of Roberts that are very clear. First of all, that he intended, it appears, to assault the victims. He also appears to have been prepared for a very lengthy standoff. He had made a number of purchases at neighborhood or nearby hardware stores in the last week of several items, a long list of items that appeared on a checklist as well, by the way, that was found in his truck. Those items include cable zip ties, lumber, eye bolts, assorted hardware. He had nails, chains, clamps, two tubes of KY jelly that he brought with him as well. Several different items, all of which police say recommended or suggested that he had planned to assault the victims, had prepared for a lengthy standoff, and that ultimately he never had plans of coming out of this alive.
Scott, at this point, we've all seen the one-room schoolhouse, and of course there are many others of its type in Amish country. Are Amish leaders saying, do they have any plans to change the layout of their schools, security practices at their school? Does that fit into their 19th century lifestyle?
That type of talk hasn't really emerged yet. I think the emphasis right now in Amish country is on coming to grips just 2 days after it happened, coming to grips with what has happened. It could be possible that those talks talk of that kind of thing would emerge, but you have to remember this is a culture that is just very trusting, very peaceful, very tight-knit, and just a very, very peaceful culture that never anticipates this kind of thing to happen. In the eyes of the state government, these schools are, of course, private schools. So security laws that may be in effect on the statewide level that pertain to public schools, of course, do not pertain to these one-room Amish schoolhouses that dot Lancaster County and many other parts of the state.
And finally, that Amish trust, that forgiveness that we've heard articulated by Amish who have been pounced on by the national media in the last couple of days, do you see it holding up under this kind of event, this kind of assault?
We've seen some tremendous displays of that kind of trust and that kind of compassion already, where we hear that the night of the shootings, the night that is Monday night after they happened, a representative of the Amish faith went to the home of Charles Carl Roberts to speak with his wife and his family and to express forgiveness for what had happened just hours after it had happened. So that perhaps is the most vivid picture to this point of how the Amish community really used their faith in such an intense way to try to cope with situations such as this.
I have to say I found that profoundly moving in the midst of all this grief and sorrow. Scott Gilbert at WITF, NPR member station in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We are talking this hour about violence in the schools and the urge to lethal violence in our country. Joining me now from Los Angeles is forensic psychologist Joel Davoskin. Colorado's attorney general hired him just after the Columbine shooting to investigate that school massacre and the motivation behind it. Davoskin is professor of psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and at New York University Med School. He's also an associate at the Threat Assessment Group, which works with companies to reduce incidences of workplace violence. He's former acting commissioner of the New York State Office of Mental Health. Joel Davoskin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Help us try and figure this out. Three times now in 1 week, and we all remember Columbine, but there's been the drumbeat since, and now we have it right in front of us. Let's look first at violence in the schools and this kind of exploitive violence we've seen in Colorado and now in Pennsylvania. You've looked closely at a lot of these cases. What do you see going on here?
Well, the first thing I would say is that typically when one of these events occurs is that people leap to explanations, often simple explanations, and usually without very much information about them. As the information trickles out about what was in a suicide note or one incident in a person's life, our experience is that people tend to make too much of that when, in fact, people are pretty complicated. And there's a reason why these investigations take time. And I think you're going to find that more and more information trickles out over time that will call into question some of the early, simpler explanations that you see in some of the media. One of the reasons that I like NPR is that you guys tend to take a slower and more comprehensive look at things, and I think that's precisely the way to look at an event like this.
We're trying to move in slow and deep here. I guess a big question is, do you see this schoolhouse violence as of a piece with national violence, violent crime on the uptick again after not being for a long time, but is this of a piece with an American cultural problem, or is it singular somehow?
Well, it certainly appears to be true that one thing that seems to be a factor, an important one, and it's a bit ironic saying this on a radio show, is that the saturation publicity that follows these events typically appears to increase the chances of other events occurring shortly thereafter. One of the reasons why some of the more spectacular TV shows where they'll show the perpetrator's face for 10, 15 minutes at a time in a huge photograph, whether that aggrandizes the person who's violent or makes it more intriguing or dramatic, it's real clear that when somebody does something like this, they're going to be the most famous person in America for a few days.
We're joined now as well from Middletown, Connecticut, by Richard Slotkin, professor of American Studies and English at Wesleyan University, author of a trilogy on violence and American society and culture, the final volume of the trilogy entitled Gunfighter Nation, The Myth of the Frontier in 20th Century America. Richard Slotkin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And with us from Millersville, Pennsylvania, not far from Nickel Mines, where this week's sad shootings took place, Diane Zimmerman Umble joins us. She's Acting Associate Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences at Millersville University. She's written a lot about the Amish, Strangers at Home, Amish and Mennonite Women in History, Holding the Line, The Telephone in Old Order, Mennonite and Amish Life. She's a native of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Diane Zimmerman Umble, thank you for being with us.
Hello.
Richard Slotkin, let us go right to you if we can. You've written so much about violence in American culture, the notion of regeneration through violence, and yet we look at the incidents of this last week and they look so twisted and dark, it doesn't look regenerative. How do you look out, first of all, on schoolhouse violence? How does it fit into your big picture of American violence and American culture?
Well, the perspective on regeneration, I guess, would be the perspective of a crazed individual that is seeking redemption through an act of violence. But the thing that I guess I could contribute to the discussion is to talk about the cultural frame in which violence takes a certain form in American society. Mm-hmm. If you look at something like murder rates and rates of gun ownership in places like Israel and Switzerland, where they have essentially a militia system.
With guns everywhere.
Most people have to keep weapons in their home. You don't have the same murder rates that you have in the United States. And I think the difference between the United States and Western Europe and the other advanced countries is that our culture allows a far wider scope for private violence by individuals.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the United States, our culture and our laws actually give individuals the right to use deadly force in a much wider range of situations.
So you don't mean just spanking the kids or domestic violence at home. You mean more scope for shooting? I mean, our laws are all against that.
No. For example, in England, the premise is that if you're confronted with an aggressor with a weapon, and you can flee, you are required to flee by law. Mm-hmm. In the United States, in many states, for a long time, there's been a law or at least an understanding that you may respond to the threat of deadly force with deadly force. Moreover, even if you have just a credible belief that you may be menaced, you can use deadly force. There was an incident back in the 1990s in Louisiana where a Japanese exchange student was trick-or-treating, and appeared at a person's door, and the guy shot him.
But what's the leap from that aggressive self-defense, more scope given for that in American culture, to five little girls dead in a schoolhouse?
Well, the question is, what is it? What is the license about? And I think that if you grant the premise that you know we do have a wider scope for personal violence. For example, we now have a lot of states now have shoot first laws, in which you by law you have a right to defend yourself with deadly force if your property is menaced.
But you keep going back to self defense, whereas what we're talking about here is murder. Defense is not an issue.
Well, we also have something called grievance killing, which we sanction, and this goes back to the 19th century. That if a person challenges your dignity and attacks your sense of self and your place in the community in some fundamental way, you're allowed to defend yourself against that, or at least juries will understand if you respond with deadly force. So, for example, in the 19th century, if a black person, or even in the early 20th century, if a black person eyeballed a white woman, or refused to give the street to a white man, it was perfectly legitimate for a white person to strike or even in some cases kill.
But next stop, school children where race is not an issue?
Take it on down. That is to say, every status in society there's a hierarchy. Husbands who kill adulterous spouses are said to be justified by an unwritten law, which is often recognized by juries. The personal sense of grievance that people have is against not the strong, but against the weak and the lowly, the woman who defies her husband, the child who accuses an abuser of abusing, is from the abuser's point of view, attacking his privilege,
and out
attacking
comes
his sense of self, and he has the right. He has in his own mind then the right to retaliate.
And out comes the gun in that
and
cultural
out,
frame.
That's right.
As you described, there's a lot more we want to hear, Richard Stockton. But let me turn, if I may, to Diane Zimmerman Umble for a moment. Diane, you know this community very well, and in a way, this 19th century community, sort of trapped in amber, there provides an interesting counter perspective or vantage point on what's going on here. The contrast seems so great. I mean, I grew up around a lot of Mennonites in the family and around. This could not be more outside their way of life or perspective. What can we learn from how the Amish see what's just happened here?
Well, and they have practiced systematically trying to create a separate kind of life. This has been the basis for many of the decisions they've made about what technologies they're going to use or what farm practices they're going to develop.
But is this part of the reason they want no part of the cultural frame that Richard Slotkin describes?
Well, they don't have a part in that cultural frame. I mean, they do not live in a culture that is saturated by media images of violence. They do not live in a culture that is filled with video games that involve shooting. So they have made decisions that have protected them from that kind of frame. Their frame is oriented in terms of the community and what's right and what's good for the community, not in terms of the individual. So even kind of individual rights are not part of the way that they look at the world.
Joel Dvoskin, what about the cultural frame Richard Slotkin describes? And if there's a sanction there for personal violence, as he said, somewhere deep in our culture, what's going on when it bleeds over into this setting, which I think has been pretty much, until Columbine at least, in the national mind, sacrosanct, the school?
I think that Professor Slotkin makes some really good points, and I would kind of extend it a little bit to say that our heroes are people who use violence to solve problems. Our society, our government, often uses violence to solve problems, and things become unthinkable until they're no longer unthinkable. And let me give you kind of an odd example is in basketball, they punish anybody who touches a referee ruthlessly because they want it to be unthinkable to touch a referee.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody crosses one of those boundaries, like you don't hurt kids, It may be true that that makes it less difficult for the next person to cross that boundary. The other thing I would like to add to this discussion is that all of these shootings have one thing in common, which is that the perpetrators did not intend to live after the events.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, to me, it means that in order to understand these events, you have to understand them not only as homicides, but also as suicides.
Does that make them about honor, about release from pain? How do you interpret it?
I wouldn't say honor, although some people may have that thought in their head, but certainly suicidologists talk about suicide as being an egress, a way of escaping from intolerable, usually psychological pain. And that may be one factor in these events, but certainly all of them involve people who have made a decision at the time they do these things that their life as they knew it was going to end. Either they were going to die, which is the most common scenario, or they were going to spend the rest of their life in prison, so that someone would have to make a decision that the things they have to live for were less than whatever was bothering them or whatever pain they were in order to cross that line and say, I'm going to do this thing this day, and my life as I knew it before is over.
But that's not just a gun to the temple. This is a gun to other people, to children. Richard Slotkin, how do you see the suicide pact piece of this? I mean, Charles Roberts, the shooter in Pennsylvania, saying he's filled with so much hate in his suicide, an unimaginable emptiness.
He's filled with two things, hate, but also a kind of self-loathing, which he has to... I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but according to what I read, he had abused children as a young person.
Well, he said that he had, in some degree, we don't really know.
And he said he was going to do it again. And I guess what I see there is that he dealt with whatever guilt he may have felt about that, not by accepting the guilt, but by affirming the rightness of his having abused somebody.
But why padlock that to an armament of guns? I mean, the abuse is bad enough, and the sexual tenor around some of these killings lately is very startling.
Because he knows that he's broken a fundamental taboo. He wants to affirm something which he knows cannot be affirmed. He's torn apart by the contradictions in those positions. He blames the victims for his psychological tension. So he goes out and finds a symbolic surrogate for the actual people he remembers abusing and affirms his old crime by not only committing the crime but topping it. He also knows that if he survives the event, that the psychological dignity that he has won by killing what he sees as the cause of his pain will be taken from him.
But somewhere
he's got to finish it off right there.
Somewhere in there, this sanction of private violence that rides along in the culture is at work, that turns it from suicide to murder. I want to bring our listeners in, if I may, from Riverside, Connecticut. Sue's calling. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting discussion. You're doing a great job of moderating it. I know it's a complicated topic. I'd like to get some comments from the participants on taking a level back, going back a level.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a crime probably going on behind these crimes, and that is the whole idea of where did they get the guns and the gun trafficking involved.
We've got a schoolhouse on every block and a Walmart with guns or another gun shop around
exactly.
the corner.
And we don't have a handle in this country on the regulation of who is getting these guns and what process they're getting them from. And a lot of times it is from an illegal market. And we need to be committed to looking into gun trafficking. Where did they get the guns?
But just as often maybe from a completely legal market in this case. Richard Slotkin, how about it? New York Times opines on its editorial page, in these killings we see an open society threatened by the ubiquity of its weapons, in which one kind of freedom, that is the freedom to bear arms, is allowed to trump all others. Is that essential to American culture?
I think it's so deeply woven into the culture that I think the Times is right. I think that if you're equal, there's the saying about Samuel Colt that he made all men equal. Mm. That if your equality depends on being quick on the draw, then your rights last only as long as it takes to meet somebody who's faster or more ruthless in the use of weapons than you are. The problem is that there's a feedback effect between a culture that sanctions interpersonal violence, revenge, and whatever, and the need to own a weapon for self-defense. And it's a self-reinforcing system. I think gun control is certainly part of the picture, but I think that the culture itself has to undergo fundamental changes before our the use of whatever weapons we have is against each other is reduced. Before cheap guns were available, Americans killed each other with knives.
And guns for a long time, as you've written. But Diane Zimmerman Umbel, you're there just miles from where this latest shooting took place. And maybe it's not just as simple as guns. The Amish bear arms. They hunt with rifles, but do they? What about their murder rate?
Well, the murder rate within the Amish community is essentially non-existent. There have been a couple of, incidences where, not in this community, but in another community, where someone who was mentally ill and schizophrenic did commit murder.
So what's the difference? They've got rifles in their closets, but they're not killing each other. Society at large is.
And violence is not an option in Amish culture. They have rejected violence from the very beginnings of their origins in the Reformation. They have refused to participate in state violence by participating in the military. They do not justify violence as a means of solving problems. They take the biblical mandate to turn the other cheek as the way to live, and they would not condone violence in any form.
It's never been more beautiful than we look at the opposite of that here. Joel Tavaskin, what about you've got the gun, and then you've got a cultural sanction. I mean, is the gun the opening to murder here, or would we pull out the knives, as Richard Slotkin says, if the gun weren't there?
Well, it's too complicated to give you a simple answer. There are countries that have many more guns than we do, as was stated earlier, with lower rates of violent crime. Certainly, the easy possession of a firearm raises the consequences of violent crime. It's much easier to kill somebody with a firearm than it is with a knife or with your fists. I think it's, as was suggested earlier by Professor Slotkin, there's an interaction here between a number of factors in our culture and the prevalence of firearms. I would point out, however, that even if we decided to change firearm policy in the United States, there's almost as many firearms in the United States as there are people, and you're not going to get them off the street anytime soon.
It takes centuries to mop up that mess.
And even with stricter laws, this is the kind of person who would have been able to purchase firearms.
Suzanne is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to focus on something that you were talking about earlier with this unthinkable, like crossing the boundaries, the unthinkable behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so like many people, I'm, of course, disturbed by the violence in the schools, but I just can't believe how sick and twisted this sexual violence against children and women and even men has become almost ubiquitous. I'm almost not surprised when I hear about these crimes and the awful, perverse element to them.
It was there in Colorado, the sexual abuse before the shooting started, and it appears to have been very much on the mind of the killer in Pennsylvania. What do you think about it, Susan?
We're outraged by this. Why, we hear it, it's almost, we're not surprised, it's almost commonplace. Why are we so accepting of these themes in our TV shows and our video games? I mean, I'm not a social conservative by any means, but it's just, even in our reporting of these crimes, we go on and on about gun control and just about how it's another school shooting, but we don't act like it's any horrible boundary that's been crossed with the gross sexual perversion that they've committed against, 10-year-old girls.
Yeah, we hear it, and I have to say it looks pretty horrible to me, but let's look at it. Joel Tavaskin, what about it? Talk about crossing boundaries. I mean, murder, pretty bad in school, the sexual piece that comes with it as well, and what's going on here? I mean, are these so men who see schools as kind of fish in a barrel, that they're our kids, let's just go do what we like?
this topic that the listener just mentioned deserves a show of its own. It's very difficult to cover it in briefly, but I'll try. There's two ways to think about this. One has to do with some of the experiences of the perpetrators of these crimes that they bring with them to the crime, and some of them have reportedly been abused themselves. And the other one has to do with their own, certainly in the last case, with his own apparent intent to sexually abuse the victims that he ultimately killed. People like Andrew Vax and others in the United States have been trying to make war on child molestation for a very long time. We don't put much, we don't put our money where our mouths are about protecting children. The people who are responsible for child protection are underpaid. There are too few of them. They have caseloads that are too high. It's very difficult for them to investigate claims of abuse against children.
But we can't turn our schools into perfect bunkers. We know that. They're too central to an open civic life. So what about the boundary crossing here? I mean, where does the permission come for these men to cross a boundary? There have always been people with sexually troubled personalities. But to go into the school with the gun and the intent to sexual molestation on a large scale, that seems like something new here.
I would agree with that. And this last killing, you know, I felt like I wasn't going to be a very good guest because as much as I know about this stuff, I don't understand it. I really don't. And I think we're, you know, hopefully more information will come out over time that does lend some sense to this. But I've been doing this for 30 years, and this is a very different crime than the other ones that we've read about. And I don't understand it. I mean, we can make up theories about whether, you know, he was trying to project his own self-blame or his guilt upon the victims. The truth is, we just don't know. I've been racking my brain trying to think of a way to understand this. And so far, I would say, I don't.
Richard Slotkin, how about yourself? You're the Gunfighter Nation guy, but we don't picture that going along with sick sexual molestation. Where does the sex piece figure in the mythology, or does it?
I think it does. I mean, you know, sexual feeling, sexual tensions is such a fundamental motive that it figures almost everywhere. But I like the thing that was just said about that we don't put our money where our mouth is on the enforcement of the taboo.
But what does that mean? Barbed wire, more metal detectors? Is that what you mean?
No. I don't think it's that. I think it has to do with the way the shapers of law and culture at the highest level work. We don't treat sex offenders, unless you know they're very poor and non-white, as seriously as we should.
Well, Mark Foley's being run out of Washington on a rail right now for emails with pages.
Let's see what he actually did, and let's see what his punishment is. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling the court will say he suffered enough, mm-hmm. and you often get that. There was just a case where a guy who had sexually assaulted a very young child. Was let off with 10 years probation by a judge because the judge thought he was too small and would suffer unduly in prison. We let people who drive drunk and kill people off because drunk driving is a vice. It's not a crime. Although if you get into a car drunk, you know you're deliberately putting yourself in the way of killing somebody.
So we're putting sex maybe in the category of minor vice. Diane, how do you look at the sexual element of this? It's so disturbing. It's hard to look at it in a way. But there it was, right in your neighborhood community.
Well, I have tended to look at the sexuality as part of the whole violence orientation, and I think we're living in a culture, aside from the kind of glorification of interpersonal violence which we see on television, we're living in a time where we are existing in a rhetoric where it's permissible to do violence to religious minorities as well. I mean, I think are building a kind of rhetorical culture that justifies creating an identity for people of a religious minority as potential terrorists.
Here an identity for young girls as potential targets. Our time is short. I want to get a call from Cambridge. Terrence is on the line. Hi, Terrence. You're on the air. Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to say to Ms. Zimmerman, I believe as well that the Amish basically have the right idea of forgiveness and loving and brotherhood and creating simple communities. And in reference to Professor Slotkin, the reality that the sick minds of the perpetrators, they assert their right to create this violence rather than accepting
limits.
The element of forgiveness. The question I would like to ask, though, is we're creating school systems and schools in which not the community is reflected or the community is able to work, but in which their bastions, their fortresses.
Do you work in the schools, Terrence?
I've worked in schools before, and when I was in schools, it was possible for they reflected the community itself. You could go into the schools and you could think of out an idea how to assist the community and
yeah.
be part of the schools. Nowadays, it's not even possible to enter a school unless you've called in advance that you're coming and that the security lets you in. And of course, this in sick minds, this reflects the fact that this is something. This is a fortress, and doing battle in the fortress perhaps gives some kind of a justification. The question I'm asking is, of course, it's a problem that reflects on the society generally, and with two wars going on now and with the militarization of our schools in New Orleans, there's been call from, I believe, the governor to have more military in the schools now that the schools have been shut down in many cases. They're looking for ex-military people to move into the schools. This is
Terrence, our time grows so short. Let us pick it up. Richard Slotkin, how about it? Lockdown in the schools, does it make them a greater target? Militarization, does it raise the gun higher or not?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a prudent measure, unfortunately. But I think that what the last caller said, the culture, we have an administration which believes that the death penalty is the proper answer, that is revenge, is the proper response to killing. That underscores the culture of revenge. We have a president who believes that it's okay to break the taboo against torture in order to deal with the conflict in which we now find ourselves.
And the next thing you've got a guy coming into a school with chains.
If that's what the highest moral authority in the culture and a man who identifies himself as a Christian is willing to tolerate, what do you expect people who take their cue from those who are above them in society to think? I think it's a rhetoric of revenge, of violence in which the moral and psychological and personal costs of taking revenge, of acting out violently, have been devalued by the people who run the society.
Well, today I say bless the Amish. Our hearts are with them, and let's look and see what we can learn there. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us. Diane Zimmerman Umble in Millersville, Pennsylvania, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Joel Devoskin in Los Angeles. Joel, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Richard Slotkin at Wesleyan University, author of Gunfighter Nation. Professor Slotkin, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.